Chapter 7 July Oxtail Soup. Ingredients: 2 oxtails, 1 onion, 2 cloves garlic, 4 tomatoes, 1/4 kilo string beans, 2 potatoes, 4 chiles moritas. Preparation: the cut-up oxtails are placed in a pan to cook with a chunk of onion, a clove of garlic, and salt and pepper to taste. It is advisable to add a little more water than you normally would since you are making a soup. A good soup that's worth something has to be soupy without getting watery. Soups can cure any illness, whether physical or mental. At least, that was Chencha's firm belief, and Tita's too, although she hadn't given sufficient credit to it for quite some time. But now it would have to be accepted as the truth. About 3 months ago, after tasting a spoonful of soup that Chencha had made and brought to Dr. John Brown's house, Tita had returned to her senses. She was at her high post in the window, looking through the glass at Alex, John's son, who was chasing doves on the patio. She heard John's footsteps coming up the stairs. She was eagerly awaiting his customary visit. John's words were her only link with the world. If only she could talk, tell him how much his presence and his conversation meant to her. If only she could go down to Alex and kiss him like the son she didn't have, play with him until they were tired. If only she could remember how to cook so much as a couple of eggs, enjoy any kind of food. If only she could return to life. She noticed a smell that struck her, a smell that was foreign to this house. John opened the door and stood there with a tray in his hands and a bowl full of oxtail soup. Oxtail soup! She couldn't believe it. And behind John, in came Chencha, covered in tears. The embrace they exchanged was brief, because they didn't want the soup to get cold. With the first sip, Nacha appeared there at her side, stroking her hair as she ate, as she had done when she was little and was sick, kissing her forehead over and over. There were all the times with Nacha, the childhood games in the kitchen, the trips to the market, the still warm tortillas, the colored apricot pits, the Christmas rolls, the smells of boiled milk, bread with cream, chocolate atole, cumin, garlic, onion. As always, throughout her life, with a whiff of onion, the tears began. She cried as she hadn't cried since the day she was born. How good it was to have a long talk with Nacha. Just like old times when Nacha was still alive and they had so often made oxtail soup together. Chencha and Tita laughed, reliving those moments, and they cried, remembering the steps of the recipe. At last, Tita had been able to remember a recipe once she had remembered the first step, chopping the onion. The onion and the garlic are chopped very fine and placed in a little oil to fry. As soon as they become transparent, the potatoes, beans, and chopped tomatoes are stirred in until the flavors meld. John interrupted these memories by bursting into the room, alarmed by the stream that was running down the stairs. When he realized it was just Tita's tears, John blessed Chencha and her oxtail soup for having accomplished what none of his medicines had been able to do, making Tita weep. Sorry to have interrupted, he started to leave the room. Tita's voice stopped him. That melodious voice had not spoken a word for 6 months. John, please don't leave. At Tita's side, John watched her go from tears to smiles as she heard all the news and gossip from Chencha. The doctor learned that Mama Elena had forbidden visits to Tita. In the De La Garza family, some things could be excused, but not disobedience, not questioning parental authority. Mama Elena would never forgive Tita, crazy or not, for blaming her for the death of Roberto. She had forbidden anyone to even mention Tita's name, just as she'd done with Gertrudis. Of course, Nicholas had returned recently with news of Gertrudis. He had actually found her working in a brothel. He had delivered her clothes to her, and she had given him a letter for Tita. Chencha gave it to her, and Tita read it to herself. "Dear Tita, you can't know how grateful I am that you sent me my clothes. Fortunately, I was still here to get them. Tomorrow I will be leaving this place, which is not where I belong. I still don't know where that is, but I know that I have to find the right place for myself somewhere. I ended up here because I felt an intense fire inside. The man who picked me up in the field, in effect, saved my life. I hope to meet him again someday. He left because I had exhausted his strength, though he hadn't managed to quench the fire inside me. Now, at last, after so many men have been with me, I feel a great relief. Perhaps someday I will return home and explain it to you. I love you. Your sister Gertrudis." Tita put the letter in the pocket of her dress without a word. The fact that Chencha didn't ask her anything about the contents of the letter was a clear sign that she had already read it, from one end to the other. Later, the three of them, Tita, Chencha, and John, dried the bedroom, the stairs, and the bottom floor. As they were saying goodbye, Tita told Chencha her decision never to go back to the ranch again. She asked her to tell Mama Elena. Chencha crossed the bridge between Eagle Pass and Piedras Negras for the 100th time without even realizing it as she tried to think of the best way to break the news to Mama Elena. The watchmen for both countries let her do it because they'd known her since she was a child. Besides, it was amusing to watch her go from one side to the other, talking to herself and chewing on her rebozo. She felt as if her talent for invention had been paralyzed by terror. Whatever version she gave, it was sure to infuriate Mama Elena. She had to invent one in which she, at least, got off scot-free. To manage that, she had to come up with an excuse that justified her visit with Tita. Mama Elena wouldn't swallow just anything, as if she didn't know it. She envied Tita for having had the courage to refuse to go back to the ranch. She wished she could do the same, but she didn't dare. She'd heard talk since she was a child about the bad things that happen to women who disobey their parents and masters and leave the house. They end up in the filthy gutter of a fast life. Nervous, she twisted her rebozo around and around, trying to squeeze out the best of her lies for this situation. It never failed. When the rebozo was turned 100 times, a tale that fit the occasion always came to her. For her, lying was a survival skill that she had picked up as soon as she had arrived at the ranch. It was better to say that Father Ignacio had sent her to collect alms than to confess she had spilled the milk by chatting in the market. The judgment earned by the two stories was completely different. Anything could be true or false, depending on whether one believed it. For example, nothing she had imagined about Tita's fate had proved to be true. All these months she had been tormented thinking of the horrible things happening to Tita away from her kitchen, surrounded by lunatics screaming obscenities, confined in a straitjacket, eating God knows what awful food away from home. She imagined that the food in a lunatic asylum, a gringo one to boot, must be the most disgusting in the world. Whereas, in fact, she'd found Tita looking pretty good. She'd never set foot in a nut house, she'd clearly been treated well in the doctor's house, and she hadn't been fed too poorly, since she looked to have put on a few pounds there. Still, no matter how much she had eaten, no one had given her anything like the beef tail soup. That's one thing you can be sure of, or else why would she have cried so hard when she ate it? Poor thing, surely now that she had left, Tita would resume weeping, tortured by memories, the thought that she would never again cook alongside Chencha. Yes, surely she was suffering deeply. Chencha could never have pictured Tita as she was then, radiant in a shiny, moiré-inlaid satin dress, dining by moonlight and listening to a declaration of love. That would have been too much even for Chencha's feverish imagination. Tita was sitting by a fire roasting a marshmallow. Beside her, John Brown was proposing marriage. Tita had agreed to accompany John under a half moon to a neighbor's ranch to celebrate the neighbor's discharge for military service. John had given her a beautiful dress he had bought for her in San Antonio, Texas, some time ago. Its multicolored fabric reminded her of the dove's plumage, the feathers around their necks. But without any sad associations with the distant day when she had shut herself in the dovecot. In fact, she felt completely recovered, ready to start a new life at John's side. They sealed their engagement with a gentle kiss on the lips. Tita didn't feel the same as when Pedro had kissed her, but she hoped that her spirit, which had been dampened for so long, would eventually be kindled by the presence of this wonderful man. Finally, after walking for 3 hours, Chencha had the answer. As always, she had come up with the right lie. She would tell Mama Elena that she'd been passing through Eagle Pass and had seen a beggar on the street corner dressed in filthy, tattered clothes. Moved by pity, she had gone over to give her a coin and had been shocked at the discovery that the beggar was Tita. She had escaped from the lunatic asylum and was roaming the world to pay for the crime of having insulted her mother. Chencha had invited her to come back home, but Tita had refused. She didn't feel she deserved to return and live with such a good mother, and she had asked Chencha to please tell her mother that she loved her dearly and would never forget how much she had always done for her, and she promised that as soon as she became an honest woman, she would return to be with her mother and give her all the love and respect that Mama Elena deserved. Chencha figured this lie would cover her with glory, but unfortunately she wasn't able to tell it. That night, when she got to the house, a group of bandits attacked the ranch. They raped Chencha. Mama Elena, trying to defend her honor, suffered a strong blow to her spine and was left a paraplegic, paralyzed from the waist down. She was in no condition to hear this type of news, nor was Chencha in any condition to give it. It was a good thing she hadn't said anything, because when Tita returned to the ranch after hearing about their calamity, Chencha's pious lie would have been shattered by Tita's splendid beauty and radiant energy. Her mother received her in silence. For the first time, Tita firmly held her gaze, and Mama Elena lowered hers. There was a strange light in Tita's eyes. Mama Elena had disowned her daughter. Without words, they made their mutual reproaches and thereby severed the strong tie of blood and obedience that had always bound them together, but could never be reestablished. Tita knew perfectly well that her mother felt profoundly humiliated, because not only did she have to allow Tita back into her house again, but until she recovered, she needed Tita to take care of her. For that reason, Tita wanted with all her heart to give her the best possible care. She prepared her mother's meal very carefully, and especially the oxtail soup, with the good intention of serving it to her so that she would recover completely. She poured the seasoned broth with the potatoes and beans into the pan where she had placed the oxtails to cook. Once that is done, all that is necessary is to let the ingredients simmer together for half an hour. Then remove from the heat and serve piping hot. Tita served the soup and took it up to her mother on a beautiful silver tray covered by a napkin whose exquisite openwork cotton had been perfectly bleached and starched. Tita waited anxiously for her mother's reaction when she had her first sip, but Mama Elena spit the soup on the bedspread and yelled to Tita to get the tray out of her sight immediately. "But why?" "Because it is nasty and bitter, and I don't want it. Take it away. Don't you hear?" Instead of obeying her, Tita turned away, trying not to let her mother see her frustration. She didn't understand Mama Elena's attitude. She never had understood it. It was beyond her comprehension that one person, whatever her relationship with another, could reject a kind gesture in such a brutal manner, just like that, so high-handedly. She was sure the soup was delicious. She had tasted it herself before bringing it up. It couldn't help but be good. She'd taken so much care in preparing it. It made her feel like a fool for having returned to the ranch to care for her mother. It would have been better to stay at John's house without ever giving a thought to the fate that might befall Mama Elena. But the pangs of her conscience wouldn't let her. The only way Tita would ever be really free of her mother was when she died, and Mama Elena wasn't ready for that. She felt an urge to run far, far away to shield the tiny flame John had coaxed up inside her from her mother's chilling presence. It was as if Mama Elena's spit had landed dead center on a fire that was about to catch and had put it out. Inside, she felt the effects of snuffing the flame. Smoke was rising into her throat, tightening into a thick knot, and clouding her eyes and making her cry. She opened the door quickly and ran out at the exact moment that John arrived to visit the patient. They crashed into each other. John held her in his arms just long enough to keep her from falling. His warm embrace saved Tita from freezing. They only touched for a few seconds, but it was enough to rekindle her spirit. Tita was beginning to wonder if the feeling of peace and security that John gave her wasn't true love, and not the agitation and anxiety she felt when she was with Pedro. With a real effort, she pulled away from John and left the room. "Tita, come here. I told you to take this away." "Doña Elena, please don't move. You'll hurt yourself. I'll remove the tray, but tell me, don't you want to eat?" Mama Elena asked the doctor to lock the door and confided to him her suspicions about the bitterness of the food. John replied that it might be the effect of the medicines she was taking. "Certainly not, doctor. If it were the medicine, I would have this taste in my mouth all of the time, and I don't. They're putting something in my food. Curiously enough, just since Tita came back. I want you to test it." With a smile at her malicious insinuation, John went over to taste the oxtail soup that had been left untouched on the tray. "Let's see. Let's find out what they've put into your food. Delicious. It has beans, potatoes, chili, and, I can't tell very well, some type of meat." "Don't play games with me. You don't notice a bitter taste?" "No, Doña Elena, not at all. But if you wish, I will send it to be analyzed. I don't want you to worry. But until they give me the results, you have to eat." "Then get me a good cook." "Oh, but you already have the best one right here. I understand that your daughter Tita is an exceptional cook. Someday I'm going to come and ask you for her hand." "You know that she can't marry," she exclaimed, gripped by a violent agitation. John kept quiet. It didn't suit him to inflame Mama Elena. There was no point, for he had resolved to marry Tita with or without Mama Elena's permission. He knew, too, that Tita was no longer so concerned about that absurd destiny of hers, and that as soon as she was 18 years old, they would get married. He pronounced the visit over, ordering rest for Mama Elena, and promising to send her a new cook the next day. And so he did, but Mama Elena didn't even see fit to receive her. The doctor's remark about asking for Tita's hand had opened her eyes. Clearly a romance had sprung up between those two. For some time she had suspected that Tita would like to see her vanish from this earth so she would be free to wed, not just once, but 1,000 times if she felt like it. Mama Elena perceived this desire as a constant presence between them, in every little conversation, in every word, in every glance. But now there couldn't be the slightest doubt that Tita intended to poison her slowly in order to marry Dr. Brown. From that day on, she absolutely refused to eat anything that Tita had cooked. She ordered Chencha to take charge of the preparation of her meals. Chencha and no one else could serve it, and she had to taste the food in Mama Elena's presence before Mama Elena would make up her mind to eat it. This new arrangement didn't bother Tita. It was a relief to delegate to Chencha the painful duty of caring for her mother, so that she was free to start embroidering the bedsheets for her trousseau. She had decided to marry John as soon as her mother was better. The one who really suffered was Chencha. She was still recovering physically and mentally from the brutal attack that had been made on her. And although it might have seemed she would benefit from not having to do any other work than cooking and serving Mama Elena, it wasn't so. At first she received the news with pleasure, but once the shouts and reproaches started, she realized that you can't have a slice without paying for the loaf. One day, Chencha went to Dr. John Brown to have the stitches removed where she had been torn when she was raped, and Tita fixed the meal in her place. They thought they'd have no problem fooling Mama Elena. When she got back, Chencha served the meal and tasted it as she always did, but when Mama Elena was given some of it to eat, she immediately detected a bitter taste. Furious, she threw the tray on the floor and ordered Chencha out of the house for having tried to deceive her. Chencha used that excuse to spend a few days in town. She needed to forget the whole business, the rape and Mama Elena. Tita tried to convince her not to pay her mother any mind. She'd known her for years, and she knew pretty well how to manage her. "Yes, child, but why should I want to add any more bitterness to the mole I've got? Let me go. Don't make trouble." Tita held her and comforted her as she had every night since her return. She couldn't see any way to draw Chencha out of her depression, to dissuade her from the belief that no one would marry her after the violent attack she had suffered at the hands of the bandits. "You know how men are. They all say they won't eat off a plate that isn't clean." Seeing how desperate she was, Tita decided to let her go. She knew from experience that if Chencha stayed on the ranch near her mother, she would never be saved. Only distance would allow her to heal. The following day, she sent Chencha to the village with Nicholas. Tita found she had to hire a cook. The cook quit after 3 days. She couldn't stand Mama Elena's demands and her terrible manners. They hired another who only lasted 2 days, and another, until there was no one in the village who hadn't worked at their house. The one who lasted the longest was a deaf-mute. She put up with it for 15 days, but she left when Mama Elena told her in signs that she was an idiot. After that, there was nothing Mama Elena could do except eat what Tita cooked, but she took every possible precaution about it. Besides insisting that Tita taste the food in front of her, she always had a glass of warm milk brought to her with her meals, and she would drink that before eating the food to counteract the effects of the bitter poison that, according to her, was dissolved in the food. Sometimes these measures alone sufficed, but occasionally she felt sharp pains in her belly, and then she took, in addition, a swig of syrup of ipecac and another of squill onion as a purgative. That did not last long. Mama Elena died within a month, racked by horrible pains accompanied by spasms and violent convulsions. At first, Tita and John had no explanation for this strange death, since clinically Mama Elena had no other malady than her paralysis. But going through her bureau, they found the bottle of syrup of ipecac, and they deduced that Mama Elena must have been taking it secretly. John informed Tita that it was a very strong emetic that could cause death. Tita couldn't take her eyes from her mother's face during the wake. Only now, after her death, she saw her as she was for the first time and began to understand her. Anyone looking at Tita could easily have mistaken this look of recognition for a look of sorrow, but she didn't feel any sorrow. Now she finally understood the meaning of the expression, "fresh as a head of lettuce." That's the odd, detached way a lettuce should feel at being separated abruptly from another lettuce with which it had grown up. It would be illogical to expect it to feel pain at this separation from another lettuce with which it had never spoken nor established any type of communication, and which it only knew from its outer leaves, unaware that there were many others hidden inside it. She could not imagine that mouth with its bitter rictus passionately kissing someone, nor those yellowing cheeks flushed pink from the heat of a night of love. Still, it had happened once. Tita had discovered it too late and entirely by accident. Dressing her for the wake, Tita had removed from her belt the enormous key ring that had been chained to her as long as Tita could remember. Everything in the house was under lock and key, strictly monitored. No one could take so much as a cup of sugar from the pantry without Mama Elena's authorization. Tita recognized the keys for all the doors and nooks and crannies. But in addition to that enormous key ring, Mama Elena had a little heart-shaped locket hung around her neck, and inside it, a tiny key caught Tita's attention. She knew immediately which lock that key fit. As a child, playing hide-and-seek one day, she had hidden in Mama Elena's wardrobe. Tucked among the sheets, she had found a little box. While she waited for them to find her, she had tried to open it, but it was locked and she couldn't. Mama Elena hadn't been playing. She wasn't one of the seekers, yet she was the one who discovered Tita by opening her wardrobe door. Mama Elena had come to get a sheet or something and had caught Tita red-handed. Tita was punished in the corn loft, where she had to take the kernels off 100 ears of corn. Tita had felt that the punishment didn't fit the crime. Hiding with your shoes on among the clean sheets wasn't that bad. Now, with her mother dead, reading the letters contained in the box, she realized she hadn't been punished for that, but for having tried to see what was in the box, which was serious indeed. Full of morbid curiosity, Tita opened the box. It contained a diary and a packet of letters written to Mama Elena from someone named José Trevino. Tita put them in order by date and learned the true story of her mother's love. José was the love of her life. She hadn't been allowed to marry him because he had Negro blood in his veins. A colony of Negroes fleeing from the Civil War in the United States, from the risk they ran of being lynched, had come to settle near the village. Young José Trevino was the product of an illicit love affair between the elder José Trevino and a beautiful negress. When Mama Elena's parents discovered the love that existed between their daughter and this mulatto, they were horrified and forced her into an immediate marriage with Juan de la Garza, Tita's father. This action didn't succeed in stopping her from keeping up a secret correspondence with José even after she was married, and it seemed that they hadn't limited themselves to that form of communication either, since according to the letters, Gertrudis was José's child and not her father's. When she found out she was pregnant, Mama Elena had planned to run away with José. But while she was waiting for him to appear that night, hidden in the darkness of the balcony, who should appear out of the shadows but an unknown man who attacked José for no apparent reason, eliminating him from this world? After that terrible grief, Mama Elena resigned herself to life with her legal husband. Though for many years Juan de la Garza had been unaware of the entire story, he had learned of it just when Tita was born. He had gone to a bar to celebrate the birth of his new daughter with some friends. There a venomous tongue had let out the information. The terrible news brought on a heart attack. That was all there was. Tita felt guilty for having discovered her mother's secret. She didn't know what to do with the letters. She thought of burning them, but she was not the one to do that. If her mother had not dared, how could she? She put everything away just as she had found it, back in its place. During the funeral, Tita really wept for her mother. Not for the castrating mother who had repressed Tita her entire life, but for the person who had lived a frustrated love. and she swore in front of Mama Elena's tomb that, come what may, she would never renounce love. At that moment she was convinced that John, who was always at her side, supporting her without reservation, was her true love. But then she saw a group of people approaching the mausoleum, and from a distance she made out Pedro's silhouette, and Rosaura with him, and she was no longer so sure of her feelings. Rosaura, displaying an enormous pregnant belly, was walking slowly. Seeing Tita, she went and embraced her, crying inconsolably. Pedro approached her in his turn. When Pedro took her in his arms, her body quivered like jelly. Tita blessed her mother for providing the occasion for her to see and embrace Pedro. Then she pulled away sharply. Pedro didn't deserve to have her love him so much. He had shown weakness by going away and leaving her. She could not forgive him. John took Tita's hand on the way back to the ranch, and Tita in turn took his arm, to emphasize that there was something more than friendship between them. She wanted to cause Pedro the same pain she had always felt, seeing him beside her sister. Pedro watched them through slits of eyes. He didn't care a bit for the familiar way John drew near Tita when she whispered something in his ear. What was going on? Tita belonged to him, and he wasn't going to let anyone take her away. Especially not now that Mama Elena, the major obstacle to their union, had disappeared. To be continued. Next month's recipe. Champandongo.